Analyze the Visionary Activist Show. I am your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. We are welcoming entheo rocket scientist Bruce Damer to co-guide us to the true origins of life, whereby to prepare, can't stop what's coming, but let's get ready. Forward planning. There we go. Bruce is currently constellating Climate Mitigation Associates with his chief trickster cahooter, which is Hannah. Right? Yes?
Yes.
Okay, that's good. So encouraging heart-driven collaborative design ingenuity, redesigning the military as competent solutionaries. So it has long been my desire, and maybe all of us too, to wed the West and East Coasts, you know, to Washington and California and what they represent. So here we're doing it. Bruce and Anna are currently here about to speak with generals and admirals. Again, we will hear more about this again. Creating the atmosphere, that's part of the design, redesigning the military as competent solutionaries and creating the atmosphere conducive to the desirable, magnetizing the field into an irresistible invitation. Pragmatic mysticism for all of us is a daily practice of dreaming mutual aid, symbiosis, community into being. His website is www.damer.com, where you can see a plethora, an extraordinary unfolding of adventures and credentials, and you know, works for NASA and many things. And also, I just want to bring in too. A follower of scientific version of the philosophy of liminality, occupying a liminal boundary between rational, reductionist, materialistic approaches to reality, but open to inspiration from alternative states. Yes, I am an entheo enthusiast. It's how we met as well. So welcome, Bruce Damer and Hannah.
Thank you. Great to be here in the witchy world of Washington.
Yes. So the witch lives out of town, just barely, but we're on the river where we can waft blessings down. And it is so great that you are such an excellent blend. The January 1962 stellium of planets in Aquarius team, you and Eddie Izzard. Right. So anyway, so it's great. But here to re-wed science and mysticism, science and myth, because of course they love each other. Yeah, I mean that's been a part of your weaving, right?
Yeah. So when mystics, the great breakthroughs in science are always created by the mystics. So the scientific community looks around because they have all become technicians. Right, and they're all pursuing these little limited goals of technical achievement, of narrow casting their grants and things like that. And then they look around, are there any mystics in our field to solve the big problem? Because very few will take those on. So, for instance, Albert Einstein at age 16 decided he was taking on the big problem of what is time and space? What is energy? What is all this stuff? And he had thought experiments of traveling running alongside beams of light. He had these dreams he called thought experiments. So when I read that when I was 14 years old, I thought, that's how science is done. It's done through dream. It's done through downloaded, delivered visions.
Right. Yeah. And I forgot which chemist it was, but he woke up excitedly from a dream of an Ouroboros, a snake biting its tail, and he goes, the benzene ring, I have dreamed it.
Exactly.
Right. And then, of course, which is it, Watson or Crick, who dropped acid? One of those guys.
It was probably Crick.
Right, okay, yeah. The other one was slightly grumpy. But Crick was saying, well, he's British, after all, going, it's not mystical, it's a thinking tool. It's like, oh, whatever, you cute little British scientist. Okay, that's right,
that's
yeah.
That's it. So that's how I thought science was done. You loaded your little noggin with all the issues and problems and the challenges, and then suddenly one day would be a delivered vision. And this has happened now to me 5 times over a 40-year period, these downloads. And each of them, I've written it actually up for a little book for Esalen, these 5 downloads, and how they led to the seeing of how life could have begun on the Earth, the cycling system in toto, completely, with all the chemical compounds moving around, the vesicles, the protocells, and seeing it all on December 30th, 2013 was when the huge download came, when all came together. From 1976, when I started and had my first thought experiment of a bundle of molecules which winked at me and said, figure out how I made a copy of myself. And that was a sort of third eye vision before I knew what a third eye was, all the way to December 30th of 2013, when the entire system just came in. And I furiously drew and wrote and sent it off to Dave Deamer at UC Santa Cruz, my colleague. And he said, you found it. You found the kinetic trap. So it was the eureka moment. And then now it's become a theory, a hypothesis tested all over the world by a dozen universities. Huh. And it was on the cover of Scientific American when we met at the Eclipse Festival in 2017. That very month was the Scientific American cover story on this work.
And you're buddies with Paul Stamets, yeah?
Yeah,
okay, that's good. No, we love the science agents of what they love come to help guide us humans into better collaborating, right?
Yeah, and the amazing thing was in 2015, I was standing on the largest petroglyph in the world.
Where's that?
The largest rock outcrop with Aboriginal, basically pounded rock art from the Rainbow Serpent to Cosmic Maps. And this is in northwest Australia. It's very hard to get to. It's called Gallery Hill. And it contains 60,000 years at least of rock art carvings that have survived out in the open. And I was standing there and I had the vision, the insight for that the origin of life was not about competing individuals. It was a common community that emerged in a hot spring, in a cycling hot spring system 4.2, 4.3 billion years ago. And that we were headed there on the bus. We literally were in a geological, astrobiological field expedition with our colleagues from Australia, and we went up to the region which preserves the oldest evidence for life on Earth, stromatolites, 3.5 billion years old. And I was able to touch the oldest hot spring ever found on the Earth that contains evidence for life. And it was just a fantastic moment. But for philosophy or for spiritual thinking or for a powerful idea for the 2020s, for our time, is that we come from a common community that basically rose through collaboration. And then, in fact, perhaps the survival of the fittest, which was Herbert Spencer's term that Darwin actually disliked but agreed to use in Origin of Species in the later editions, created so much social Darwinism, so much bad behavior, and in fact, there may be no individuals, actually, that there's only community, there's only collaborative networks, and that's the unit of selection, and that's the substrate or the matrix which supports life, and always has, a microbial mat, which grew up into forests and plants and then supported grazers like us, you know, to do funny, tricky things to the atmosphere, which brings us to the climate mitigation, the climate crisis issues. But the fact that we may have discovered, or that science may be on the path to discovering how we began, I mean, all of us, not just humans, but how life can be lifted from the background of the cosmos, the physics of the cosmos, the very engine of creation we may be on the verge of discovering, that turns out that engine not only creates life and spins up living cells, but it creates everything else, including conscious experience, technology, culture. Everything is created by one engine, and that we may have found the source for consciousness or the source for the field, you know, this whole synchronous field thing that we're in, the field that today bumped us off KPFA.
Right, and into free range.
Into free range. And right. So the field is this synchronous magical network that arranges unlikely things to come out of the background. But that's exactly the same thing that happened at the protocell level at life's origin. It was a network effect. And that is the greatest tool humanity will ever have, is the contact with the field. And I call it God for geeks.
Well, it's not just humanity, though, is it?
It's everything is connected.
Yeah, I mean, the field, right, exactly. So we wanted to throw out, we have a giant cauldron just for the fun of it. I like throwing humanism in. Humans is the measure of all things. You know, may the hubris of humanism be thrown in, and the truth of participatory animism. be ladled out. Yeah, everything alive. Which is why, yeah, just even from the stage in Symbiosis, going, oh, all you smart guys, yes, we can go to Mars, but not till the wolves can go too, or not till we've cleaned our rooms, right?
It's got to
include everybody. We'd be nothing without the flora, fauna, the critters. But no, that's great. No, and I will toss it right back to you, but. Yeah, survival of the fittest was always used to justify the most cruel aspects of capitalism, the social Darwinism, kind of like, you know, the biblical equivalent. I love cahooting with Neil Douglas Klontz, Aramaic scholar. Aramaic is the language that Jesus would have spoken. And he says, what comes to us as blessed are the meek, used to justify all kinds of stuff, right? In Aramaic, this highly metaphoric, symbolic language would be more like, blessed are those who soften emotional rigidity within their heart, for they shall have all the power of nature.
Wow.
You could work with that a lot more. That's really
he did the real Lord's Prayer, right?
Right. Well, and the Lord's Prayer, and then we'll to and fro it back. But Neil also says, you know, Jesus never used the word Lord. That came in way feudal later, you know, because that's what we're doing. We're liberating scientific and social theory from its sneaky colonialism, you know, that goes way back, and we're visiting these forks in the road. So there's all that. So he never used the word Lord. And Neil's translation of the Lord's Prayer into Aramaic, it's O Abwun. And he goes, Abwun is O Father, Mother, Ongoing Creating. He says, that's the closest you can get to it. O Father, Mother, Ongoing Creating. And then apparently when people went to Jesus and talked about the end times, he said, are you so full of participating in ongoing creating you can waste your time worrying about... Mm-hmm. Now we get to the horribilization, right?
Horribilization.
So the field, right, that we are an intimate participatory... collaborative resonance, no matter what, right? Horribilizing or beautifying, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that this is why I call the field God for Geeks. So it's a new God. It's a God made up of this massive emergent densifying network, which is arranging stuff faster and faster. And we can all feel it. And it isn't embodied. It's not impersonating anything. It doesn't have ethics and judgment. It's an OS, an operating system. That you can make calls to. It has interfaces and apps. And if you have strong will, intention, and courage, and a clarity of the vision you see, it's a server call to this field, which then starts arranging things to make this a reality, which has happened here on our trip to D.C. for less than 24 hours.
Right.
The field is like cranking away, saying, okay, roll those marbles down the valley of probability, and as long as you pick them up, I'll keep opening that valley of probability to extraordinary outcomes. And when you come at it with anxiety, you know, end times and this and that, you shake the interface, so the interface gets all super noisy, and you can't... You can't get guidance from the field, and you can't put it in. It's all the fake news and all the kind of thing, which is the
right. Although I remember you saying to the Trickster Council, and I'm always so impressed when incredibly accomplished people say this thing, like, "No, I watch no TV, and I do no social media." I go, "I saw you on Facebook." Ha ha! Wait a minute. That's right. Okay, so you do some.
Yeah.
You do some. Right. Because we all do some. Because we're. But anyway. But that's yeah. That is. A great point. Yeah, the anxiety, the overwrought, which feeds the dementors of doom, that I like to call them. They feed on strife and polarity and anxiety and fear and dread. So it's like, ah. So you are a good, you know, you go, let's not horribleize it. These are profound, important dynamics. And you have said, you know, but let us move quickly and calmly.
Yeah, and this is where Hannah comes in.
Oh, good.
So, I was at the IONS conference, Institute of Noetic Science, and met someone named Julia Mossberg, who does precognition. She has a book about precognition, which is an interesting thing. It's a field kind of a thing, that you know something's going to happen before it happens. I saw her sitting there, and next to her was this wonderful being. And she knew that I had this passion for a climate mitigation, like creating a large international network of experts to really calmly and coolly help
and deliberately. I love the word deliberate, too.
To deliberately guide everything from governments to local groups and act as a switchboard and a network and in these mega projects that are going to happen to bridge us over the climate shocks. And that's as far as I'd gotten. Mm-hmm. And I sat next to Julia, and Julia said, "Meet Hannah. She could be your new. She could be your CEO of this effort." And that's the Malcolm Gladwell blink moment.
Oh yeah.
And so in comes Hannah.
And
listening to a conversation that's converging, what I am reminded first is Rilke's line, where let life happen to you, believe me, life is in the right always. In that sense, we're really calling the same thing by different names, the gods, life, collective consciousness, in a more secular, a grounded ontological and evolutionary explanation. It'd be Yuval Harari's explanation of it was how it was a collaboration that propelled humanity to become such a dominant species, not anything else, because most animals, they do collaborate, but their collaboration circles are much smaller. Mm-hmm. Humans have the capacity to collaborate across much larger bandwidth of fellow humans in ways other animals don't.
More than whales, more than everybody.
More than anyone else. Okay. And it was the power of that collaboration that allowed us to come up with those crazy innovations that propelled us. Some of it has its negative impact, like advance of agriculture methodologies in a way have one side of it, it eradicated the effect of famine that we so desperately needed to work against. But one thing I'm realizing, having worked in various macroeconomic issues and economic development and social impact, primarily in Africa and emerging markets, when we solve one problem, we create another because of the interconnectivity. And it's not always possible, but we can try. When we design things, it has effects. It's a very interesting argument also if you look at medical terms. What we call side effects of any medication is just the effects that we don't like.
Right. No, that's what Bruce said. Well, it's just effects, right?
And it's all redesigning of all of those things coming together. But what makes our current challenge much more imminent and very time sensitive is that everything is accelerating. It's not moving in a linear fashion. So we're at inflection points. But, and we can look at that. We can see that in terms of just company valuations. Exponential growth companies. It's only in the last few decades where we could fathom the idea of a company that has a billion valuation in the first 2 years of inception. That was just not technologically possible. So this acceleration allows us both a potential for mega problems as well as mega solutions. And what in our conversation in the last few weeks and months of brewing this climate moonshot associates, we're just shifting from mitigation to moonshots, realized that's actually capturing what we are trying to birth to the world much better. In this sphere, we have to account for what are those exponential technologies and where are the disconnect. So when we're going back to the idea of collective consciousness, it's actually going back to another interesting article that I read recently where ants individually don't know where they're going, but collectively together with they know where they're going. So there is some collective consciousness or wisdom that actually emerges. It's the inclination or visceral feeling that I had, ideas spread like virus. When time comes, the idea is not actually attached to a single person, as much as I love Einstein, for example, that if it was not him, it would have been someone else or many someone else's, where the ideas are ripe and it comes to the surface and it wants to be expressed.
Right.
However, individual responsibility and or collective teamwork becomes really important then to come together to make that vision. If we can see it concretely enough, we can make it happen. To do that, there's such a humongous power to get the right networks of people, right networks of organizations, right network between, say, capital, innovation technology, and projects and people coming together. There may be some of that collective neural network connection that we could help. There's not as much. There's so many nodes happening. There's a blockchain node. There's IoT node. There's climate node. There's human consciousness node. There's trend tech node. There's wisdom 2.0. There's health 2.0. There's heart-based
I need a mango and a furry dog right now. I mean, just that sensual incarnation so the words can paint the thing going, that's good, that's good. Yeah, abstraction seeking to incarnate into sensuality. But yeah, and I will toss right back to you. But that idea also that there is a participatory field. You know, the way the astro language speaks, it says astrology is this exquisite language of our interior psyche, and its separation by a thin membrane we call identity from the whole vast conversation, right? Cultural, even biological conversation. And, you know, one of my favorite humans also is a forensic psychiatrist, and her job is to go into crime scenes and maintain kinship with the perpetrator. The idea there is no strictly personal crime. It's all a public dream. She, you know, children killing their mother. She goes, we are killing our mother. But on the other, you know, and the same with illness or anything, it's all collective. But what you're cahooting with, which is so that's the crime and the pathology, but there's also a collective, you know, positive dynamic.
We make the environment, and the environment makes us. There's a feedback loop, both individually and collectively. And we understand that. It's not an if. We do understand that. And this is a conversation I had with the best brains in Silicon Valley around AI and how AI is going to be pushed into every vertical of our life designs and products and services. And how we design it, we'll design it based on what we know. Everything we design is based out of what we can see. But there's a difference between designing based on who we are right now versus designing for who we believe we can be and should be. And that's both the system design as well as at a very meta level. At the very heart of it, it's a question of how do we answer, who am I, who are we, and who can we be?
And can we go back to humans, so that crucial thing that you said, and I was like, oh, well, yeah, okay, that humans have the largest capacity to cooperate on large scale. Also, all this war, all this stuff could be inhaled back, right, which is what you're doing with the military, redirected into massive collaboration more than any other known, even mushrooms and wolves, other creatures. So this is our opportunity, responsibility as a species.
It's a human-to-human collaboration first, and in that design also interweaving the question of what is climate. It has a humanity component and there's nature component, and we're not trying to fix the problem of nature alone because it's interconnected. And at the same time, when we collaborate at a very concrete business capitalistic level.
Let's find another word. Mossy or something.
And that's, on a capital design, the whole macro design level, we are in essence trying to include the externalities of pricing that we used to not do that in economics terms.
I need a mango. Well, like, what would that look like?
So,
in a something we could see engagement.
So, for example, oil and gas companies and or military consumption, they are one of the biggest carbon polluters on the planet, more than 140 countries combined together. And part of that conflict between humanity or U.S. military or the oil and gas companies versus nature comes in because we are not pricing in how it affects all the rest of humanity or all of us together in terms of, say, for example, cancer or any public health issues or the skyrocketing rate of neurological disorders, whether it's Alzheimer. I mean, I think the number on the probability of any anyone getting Alzheimer's in their old age is, I don't have the exact number, but it's phenomenally high.
Right.
And the instances of autism, it used to be one in a couple hundred, and now it's one in six. I think it actually might be even higher just within the span of the last few decades.
Right.
While we cannot pinpoint, because the system is so complex, as the exact location of what causes those issues, whether it's public health concerns on neurological disorders and or just mystery pain issues that people are experiencing, part of the rampant depression and anxiety, and some of the recent research is indicating that actually might be biological inflammation issues.
Like what? What does that mean?
Biological inflammation ends up causing your biochemical.
Oh yeah! Oh, I thought you said the inflammation. Inflammation.
Right. Inflammation.
That's right.
Right.
No,
inflammation.
Well, and it's all speaking to us. You know, it's again, we don't want to be inflamed. We don't want to feed the dementors. We don't want to. I mean, all of that. What serves life? What feeds the desirable?
Or the simplest one to talk about is microplastic. How much microplastic? How much plastic bottles are we consuming? Millions. In a single minute around the world. And where do we think it's going to go? It's got to go somewhere. It's going to land in water, air, or land. That's about it. It's not going to shoot itself out of the atmosphere, right? And we are then consuming it, filtered or not, through the water system,
yep.
In the air.
Yep. Yep.
And it's not organic. It's not organic. Fish are dying with their belly full of plastics as well as microplastics.
Yeah.
What we see of what's happening to the sea animals, it is happening to us just at a less visible
scale. So what is the desirable vision of ingenuity coming into play in this horrific realm where so many people are working on the plastic, you know, And yeah, we're all headed to Bioneers possibly or something. I mean, there are gatherings where people are reporting in on actual stuff they're doing, which is heartening. But yeah.
Yeah, so basically we have to pivot humanity, starting with probably finance, because politics isn't really going to get you there. Politics is kind of stuck, right?
And right, but I loved the other night you said politics's influence is diminishing every breath we take or something.
It really
like,
is.
Oh, well. What a relief. That's a heartening thought.
We can't look to so-called elected leaders to take any action because they're short-term. They're kind of half of them are half crazy. Let's face it. That's how they got elected, by being half crazy. But they're not don't want to generalize on that. But they're not the kind of measured, reasonable, rationable, long-term planning kind of people we need. And where you find it in this town, in Washington, D.C., where you find those long-term planning people is actually in the Department of Defense, in the military. You find people who deeply care about the whole system, not just national security of this country, but they're deeply care and they're very transparent. They're very easy to talk to. And they come from the largest agency, the largest organ of the federal government is the DOD, by far. It's a third of the budget or something like that. And throughout the DOD and its retired people are these people who think long-term planning. And that's why we're meeting first with the admiral I met in Qatar, in the Middle East in January. We're very different. He's career military intelligence, rear admiral. And here I am, a kind of a hippie and theo scientist from Northern California, but we fell in love at the shores of the bay, the Big Pearl Bay in Qatar.
So your wizard hummed his inner wizard?
We both realized we love forward planning and scenarios and thinking in terms of decades or even centuries, and that he loved it too. And we were looking out from the Muslim Museum of Art across the bay at this half-trillion-dollar city that had been built, realizing that that's going to be rusting scaffolding in 30 to 40 years because of sea level incursion. It's built completely at sea level, not a foot above sea level, that entire thing. And the nation of Qatar realized we screwed up. We didn't plan for sea level rise, let alone rainfall, with no street drainage in the country. So what occurred to us is to hold a national and international convention about this issue, to move the whole system at once, starting with the military is full of the planners and full of highly credible people. That being his background, finance, there's trillions of dollars of funds locked up in funds that aren't really working. Put them to work. There's mega projects, like the government of Qatar is going to spend $50 to $100 billion to solve this problem. Google and Facebook have new campuses at sea level and have already expressed their concerns.
Well, you said before that, you know, the long term, that Qatar will have the World Cup, you know, and after that they'll have some $100 billion to spend on.
They will have to, yeah, and they're waking up to that. So there'll be an early mover in the 2020s. But so here's what the climate moonshots effort will do. Mm-hmm. So it will identify. We came up with just an hour or two ago, 22 moonshots. So okay. Why 22 is for the 22nd century. That can we accomplish?
And the 22 major arcana. Okay, there we go. That's right.
One of them might be. It's a moonshot. It's a proposal. It's a challenge. Say, can we make a living seawall?
Right.
Okay. A living seawall. So instead of like Army Corps of Engineers, us pours a ton of concrete, which is a big CO2 emitter, and it's not a long-term solution. Not for centuries. Right?
Mm-hmm.
What if you build a new kind of living seawall which self-repairs and it provides an ecological basis, an ecological restoration? So you build not one but two gabion basket or some technology seawalls next to each other, and in between you have fresh or salt water, marshlands or wetlands that are replenished, so that instead of a million miles of seawall, which is producing nothing, you have introduced a massive new ecosystem for fish and for fowl and for even agriculture. So seawalls are alive.
And right.
They're new forms of land, actually, and they're regenerative. They're absolutely regenerative. And so you put that in as a climate moonshot challenge. And then what we do is connect venture finance to incubators. We hold great conferences and salons and meetings, and the people show up who say, I have an idea for a living seawall. And so then little companies get started. The little companies innovate and do their testing and their, you know, their rounds of funding like we do in Silicon Valley. They build a viable platform for a living seawall. Then big capital comes in. So Skidmore, Owings, Merrill does a big study for Qatar on its seawall, then recommends a living seawall, which will provide agricultural output for the country, which doesn't produce any food. Now it will produce food with this new design, and then they implement $50 billion, and then it's a model for the world. And so sea level rise, the response to it, the mitigation of it, is a massive improvement in coastal ecosystems, agricultural output. The investment has multiple payoffs and spin-offs in decades to come. So it'd be a better way to go in solving that problem. And so in a way that one moonshot ties into several other moonshots and solves multiple problems all at once.
Right. And then just to pause, and then we will get back to the 21 remaining moonshots that you already have outlined. That's so impressive. Yay, science mind, both of you. Because it's also, you know, what is unique to our species aside from our rogue disrespect for boundaries and rudeness and all. And so, okay, cooperating on a large scale, that's completely intriguing. More than mushrooms, more than fungi, more than all that. Absolutely. Even though Paul Stamets says that mushrooms created the internet, okay, to help save us. All right, no, that's really great. And then Michael Stewart on E says, Dishitu, the spirit of mushrooms and the people he lived with in Brazil. Their science, they say that humans, the unique carbon dioxide that humans exhale is what causes plants to have perfume. I go, all right, I like that. Well, we don't know. Okay, we'll put that back there. But also, you know, our capacity to borrow design from nature, you know, and from the flora fauna, which is all part of this, you know, the biomimicry dynamic, right? But what you've just said with the Qatari seawalls, and we can, you know, see it as you've been teasing it into Lake Pontchartrain and New Orleans and all of these, and well, everywhere. You know, when have humans made something that was collectively beautiful you know, and that fit in with nature, in which you go, that's beautiful. Adobe, maybe, some ancient cities, and now you're bringing up, you know, the sea green, the green sea walls as a boon. And what is Doha like in Qatar? Is it beautiful? Is it crazy? Is it a giant shopping mall? What is it? What's going on there?
It's all of those things. It's a dream.
It's a dream.
But it's what Doha is fascinating. It's a place that is very plastic and malleable because it has a single set of visionary leaders. Her Royal Highness, who's the head of Qatar Foundation, has like completely revolutionized education there, creating a whole education city, and they have the ability to act as a unit quickly, and they have the resources because they're a natural gas superpower, so they can be a model. So they could green Doha and green Qatar within a generation. They could do it. They have the power to do it. So in a sense, they're a laboratory. So right now it's Ritz-Carlton's and
Gucci shoes
yeah. And you know, lots of tower blocks everywhere.
Well, lots of terrorist targets, really, and rightly so, in a way, the Gucci shoes and the thing and the
whatever. They're sort of isolated by disputes with their neighbors, Saudi Arabia and UAE, but then they're backed by Turkey and by us.
To stretch out the field here, another really great radio guest that I've had, who wrote the book The Wahhabi Code, and he says few Westerners know, and it's all about Saudi Arabia and few Westerners know that until 1928, in terms of the field, Mecca was this wonderful place of Sufi celebration and beauty and art and tolerance, a really positive field, right? And then the Saudis and Wahhabi, you know, invade and literally pave over a parking lot, pave over the Prophet's daughter's house and create a parking lot. You know, but again, that's important to remember, you know, that it was beautiful.
Yeah, and
and tolerant.
They call it the Walmartization of Islam.
Mecca?
Yeah. There's a fellow here who's a converted Muslim who's written extensively about this. I forget his name. He's on Facebook, but he's written, I think he wrote about the Walmart of Islam being Wahhabism.
Right.
And but yeah,
and that's the misappropriation of, you know, mega money and fear.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Here we will either kill you or give you $5 million. Oh.
Now, so Qatar is interesting because it sort of is a counterexample of that. And so we support the beautiful, you know, emergence of something new. And they created, her father, Sheikh Khalid, created Al Jazeera.
Right.
Right? In his words, to shake up the sheikhs.
Right. We love Al Jazeera.
So that's where, so in a sense, it's a tiny country at a juxtaposition, many worlds, which is, it's an interesting pivot point as the Middle East goes. And it's one of the largest carbon generators on the planet, being a natural gas superpower. You know, exporting natural gas. That's why I think it's the third most wealthy country on the world per capita. So it's a place. And the admiral that we're meeting tomorrow, he's been going back there pretty often. And we're probably going to go there and potentially propose a climate moonshots event there for them. And they will jump on it and sponsor it. And we'll maybe start with small meetings and get larger. Because if you can identify the five or six moonshot projects that could be tried in a living laboratory like this small country, tried out, engineered, built, and delivered, right, between now and 2030, then it's a laboratory where you can test out all these things, and then it could be copied by the world. So it's not a bad place to have a garage to try out your tech.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's also, you know, it's interesting, again, you know, another ally, David Bloom, alcohol can be a gas, who's been working to turn everything and every piece of garbage into ethanol, you know, and then refit the, you know, and it is, oddly, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries that are most interested in investing in his technology because they know. We wish him well, and we want these things. See, again, what I think you can do is tease it into actuality. Because he's had fantastic ideas for years, right? And he goes, and I went to the Amazon and I told them, you know, how they could have one of these generators and they would never need gasoline again. I go, yes, yes, and then I left. And I'm like, no, come back and do it. Come back and do the thing. But he's also just beginning to get mega funding. So a lot of the dreamers are who've been wailing in the wilderness for a while are now getting funding from the Middle East, you know, mm-hmm. quirkily. Yeah.
Yeah, so for all the listeners out there, Hannah and I would like to invite you to consider your own moonshots, climate moonshots, and we're going to stand up a website, a community, a crowdsourced effort, but also an internally supported effort. We're going to be having member companies, organizations, and think of what we're doing as a kind of giant switchboard. And by defining these 22 moonshots, it's like the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, which really had an impact. People refer to them, they can understand what they are. They can read them quickly on their phones and understand, and then it links to the projects for the SDGs.
Right.
So this would be similar. Now, if you have a similar effort out there, we can join forces, because mm-hmm. perhaps others have come up with this idea that just occurred to us over in a cafe in Bethesda.
You know, which cafe were you in? Oh, there we go.
The Lilith Cafe in Bethesda, Maryland.
Excellent. Excellent. That's good. Connecting to the ancient Bethesda of the Old Testament. But no, because I think it's that's so fabulous. And it is the irresistible invitation. You know, to snap people out going, here, we need everybody's awakened imagination to do this, to cooperate. Here's a larger story. Here's a better story. The antidote, I think, to the Dementors and the horribilization, because it's so, you know, which creates mob mind and invites the worst of humans to, you know. So it behooves us, we want to invite the best, right? The collaborative ingenuity, the noble thing. So the ingenious, the disobedient, ingenious, maverick, dreaming tech thing. And just as a little, you know, back to what you were saying, that yeah, the field. So in my quirky world, you know, I had different clients, some military on occasion, and it's like, no, don't look at the uniform, just look at the chart, and yes, they do want to do good things. And then for a while, there were cops coming for astrological readings, and one said, don't tell my partner. But I had this precognition. We were going to this, and I know it was really freaked out. But don't. And then his partner comes and goes, "Don't tell my partner." But I had this, you know. And I go, you know, everyone's having it. And again, to create that field of to dissolve shame about what we should be most proud of, right? This field, because it does exist. It's just been suppressed. You're like, oh no, I'll get fired, or that's a trouble. But it's happening all the time.
Underneath that fear, I think it was a quote that went, underneath that fear and pain. Underneath that fear and pain, what remains and a bigger source is love. The outcome is very different when we do things out of fear versus out of love. Love becomes an expression. And for the next 10 years, it's such an important inflection point. It's going to be make or break. This is not the time for neither hope and neither fear or despair, but of action, an action that is born out of love and expression and creativity. I mean, if you think about it, of all the dreams, if we're all collective dream makers and dream receivers, if you're going to dream, dream a beautiful dream. And now we have so much tools at hand to make that hopes and dreams into reality. And that's why the moonshot part of it is important. It's the 1,000x that we can bring on board, because things are accelerating. And instead of doing it out of fear that things are going to collapse, everybody's angry, and when you're angry, you're antagonizing the other. There is no other. We're all in it together. There's a single spaceship.
Right. Although, you know, and then I'll just sort of default to my intrinsic animism, you know, because I love Buckminster Fuller talking about Spaceship Earth. But I go, you know, I prefer, you know, machines analogized to living things as opposed to the other way around, just because it gets tricky. But anyway, but that's good. You beings are from grown up mystic science world. So Liberty Hall. But it's like when we were speaking the other night, and you said, you know, God for Geeks, it's an operating system, which is completely interesting. And I said, for me, because we want a collaborative, you know, I think of God as a giant in it, just a giant field coyote, you know, bowing down in front of each one of us and collectively going, woof, woof, want to play? And we go, yeah, dangerous in a good way, the kind of spicy thing. Because the entheogens give us a, you know, a shape-shifting. I mean, I think it's a good reach to go, operating system, giant coyote, really same thing. You know, again, however we want to dance in an intimate fashion. But yes, so yes, precognition, common. Well, because, you know, one of the things that astrology says is that all technology is crude literalization of intrinsic human capacity, you know, this telepathic thing. And then it goes with Sir Herbert Reed saying only those serving an apprenticeship to nature can be trusted with technology, that it is a collaborative endeavor. So but that's what you're both exhorting, right? And presumably there are endogenous receptors in all of us to the quality of invitation that you're extending, right? Little receptors going, yes, 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 we remember that. Oh, what a good idea.
Well, the God part of it, I think there's a part where we are the gods that we've been praying to.
Yeah, right. I mean, I don't love the God word. You know, and it's interesting, all the different forms in popular culture kind of grappling like with this, going, well, how did we get here? And what are some forks in the road we might want to revisit, you know, about our dynamic? And I'm getting a space out moment. But I do like the little diagram of, you know, we start off embedded animism, participatory, like hi there, hi there, what's good? And the sense of self is a little dotted line, and then we set forth to knowledge and pyramids and trigonometry and fantastic things. But it's getting, you know, and then we have church and state, and then we have humans as the you know, most important. A friend, Rick Tarnas, calls the Da Vinci the line, the download moment, going, oh, that's where the fingers touching, and then we get to modern psychology that was like, oh, it's all nonsense, right? But the sense of self is a little solid line, you know, at tremendous loss. And so one of the ideas is now, right, in democratic animism, scientific mysticism, now we go back with all the value of our knowledge, individual journey, back into kinship, back into participatory kinship. And it's like the Mabinogian, the Welsh Arthurian legends. I use this a lot, but it's so great. They're really pitching to us. The stories were gathered in the 10th century, but they're much older. And there's a moment where the elders get together and they go, uh-oh, the men just found out they have something to do with children, and things were going so well before then. And we can see what's going to happen, that humans will set forth on their individual path until they lose kinship not only with each other, but with nature herself, until the earth might die. And then, at some point, some humans will keep all the value of their unique journey and rejoin back into participatory kinship. They wrote this pre-10th century, right? So it's like, okay. So, yeah, all the myths, all the teachings, all the science, all the everything, you know, wanting to dance in this syncretism. Sufi Aikido and all.
Beautifully painted and said, Caroline, beautiful.
Yeah. So, well, here we are. That's right. We are available, and you know, and we go. Yeah. Those curves that going. The knowledge is good, and the individuality might have been necessary, and now we return. Right. So, yeah. So the moonshot of the living seawall is great. So do you both think? Is it a vision that the rising seas for most cities can be resolved with these beautiful seawalls? What do you think? Or there's triage. We let Miami go. What is it?
Well, you know, it's interesting talking to the admirals of the Navy, because you might ask, the listeners might ask, why is the U.S. Navy so interested? Well, they're affected. So the submarine ports, the naval they're affected. They are on the sea. They are of the sea. They live on the sea. They study it. They actually care deeply about it. It's their core process is oceans.
Hmm.
So it's really coming into their psyche as this is what we care about. And their mission is defend the United States. Now, if the United States is undersaturating early salt incursion, so it's not that you need a foot of sea level rise. If you have a few inches and then more powerful superstorms, the sea can bring its salt water into, say, Chevron's refinery complexes in South Texas.
And right.
When you get salt in there, just like the New York subway with Hurricane Sandy, it destroys equipment. So it's that first warning shot we've already received from this thing. It's salt.
And Republicans in Florida already were talking to Orlando, going, "Are you ready for us? Because you know, very soon, 30 years, South Florida will have no fresh drinking water."
Yeah. So in a sense, last conversation I had with them was. The comment came out, which five islands do we think Florida should be?
Okay.
Which five islands?
Hmm.
Because if the storms get more powerful, which they will.
Right.
And there's another consequence.
And do take the storms flowing into the Central Valley in California. Come back to that. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, so,
yeah.
So that one's fascinating. And so what we can do as a group, as a Climate Moonshots group, is to connect the dots. Because we essentially we would like to be the conveners of the meetings, sort of the wizards' councils in a sense. One of them is this unique thing that occurred last November when I went to see Dave Muffley, my friend down in Santa Barbara, who, with Steve Jobs, starting in 2011, they designed the Apple campus, the brand new Apple campus, $7 billion project. And he and Steve decided to plant 6,000 oak trees. And because Steve, apart from his family, his favorite thing in the world was to walk among oak forests.
And
then they realized, as they were laying out the oak forest with Sharpies on a big rolls of paper, which showed the Apple campus, they realized we have to use different oak trees. We can't plant Cupertino oak trees. We have to plant oak trees tolerant to climate change, and we're going to plant 6,000 of them, and they will spread their genes. And make all the oaks of Northern California gradually more tolerant.
Mm.
So Dave literally went to Mexico and Tucson, collected acorns, brought them back, hired 21 nurseries, and grew 6,000 oak trees and put them in the ground, and now they're growing. And when I visited him in November, he said, Dave had just put this together. He said, wait a minute. Well, I was watching the storms come into Mexico from the Gulf of Mexico. And they're more and more powerful, and they're dumping their rain on Arizona. They usually do. But now they're pushing toward the Southland. And the storms from Baja are pushing toward Los Angeles in the summers. And so in the 2030s, at the current rate, superstorms and downgrade probably to tropical storms are going to plow through the Central Valley of California, dumping 10-inch hot rainfalls. And if you talk to agribusiness or an individual, you know, almond farmer about that, they'll say, we'll lose everything here if that happens, even 1 year. And Dave pointed out, we're going to lose all the oak forests of California due to fungal infections, as he knows. And so Blade Runner 2049, the film, which shows a cop car landing next to a dead oak tree in 2049 next to a hydroponics massive farm in the Central Valley, was correct.
Oh.
They nailed it.
I missed that part.
They didn't know.
Right.
That was the opening scenes of the film.
Mm.
And so basically there's this whole scenario now that we can track. It's not a woo-woo scenario. This is an actual scenario. So what we do is go to the Central Valley, to agribusiness, to individual farmers, and calmly and carefully present this as a possibility, and then they self-organize and work together. So instead of for example, they have to transform. What they'll do, the prediction we have is they'll move rice farming from north of the Sacramento River down into the Central Valley because they'll be able to do it with that amount of rainfall.
We will have learned everybody permaculture technique of storing.
Yeah.
So
we can now store new rainfall sources. Mm-hmm. So it's not all bad, but
right.
That means probably they cannot grow almonds. That's going to disappear. And even vegetable crops, some of them are going to disappear. But if they start planting now, it won't be a shock. It'll be a gradual adaptation. And the United States will not lose a fifth of its food source, which is the Central Valley of California. It's a security.
So we'll be becoming more Japanese, more Asian in our rice.
It could be.
Patties.
But this is all about that. That's another climate moonshot, which is how do you transform a major agriculturally important area through through a climate shock? How do you do that? That's perhaps another moonshot. And the Central Valley is organized, and the people are sensible. And if they have enough time in advance, they should be able to pull this off, and so that we don't lose a huge food source. So anyway, that's another example of what this kind of working together can bring.
That's great. So we're going to conclude part one of this unfolding. Thanks very much to Ahana and to Bruce Damer. Damer.com is an excellent place to go. And we're going to be continuing this series because we're it's like, all right, first the water, the fabulous, you've described them, and I sort of see them, the seawalls, and they're green. You meant green, but I sort of see them as, can they be aqua? Can we make them different colors? Can it be all artful? Anyway, more on that next week or soon. Thanks always to KPFA, the team. I'm Caroline Casey, Coyote Network News, and we will be re-cahooting next week from the world and Bali and ingenious solutions all over. Thank you very much, team.
Oh, yeah,